You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, May 8th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the three-time award-winning News and Politics show with the Podcast Awards. The Majority Report. Oh, I tried to go a little bit of a mouthful there. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On
we are not
show.
Sam Steeter, folks.
Obviously. I think they gathered that. We have a pretty sharp audience. Folks, Sam could not make it in today, but he did do an excellent interview for you earlier this week. So it's a fresh pre-record with Steve Berzuka, who's a professor. He's a senior lecturer of public health at the University of Washington. He's going to be talking about the inequality crisis and why it's bad for your health. Then we're going to take you into the fun half. Got a bunch of great stories for you. So no fear. We have a great show for you. Best of all worlds, I would say.
This is the interview we were going to provide you today, whether Sam was here
That's
or not.
Right.
So
That's
you're
right.
not missing out. So freebie members, we are going to tell you now that you can support this show by becoming a member today at majority.fm. And you click become a member and you could sign up through PayPal or email us and we'll tell you where to send the check. You can also support this show by downloading the app for your iPhone or Android iOS actually, because you get it for your
iOS.
iPad. iOS or Android device at majorityapp.com. It is free. Download it, and if you already have it, download it on the devices of everybody you know.
Exactly. Relentlessly harass your friends about it. Buy your stuff, buy your crap on Amazon through our Amazon link, which is on the homepage. Click on that link. Makes no difference to you. Gives us a cut. Like us on Facebook. Subscribe to us on YouTube. Follow us on Twitter. Fair trade, justcoffee.coop. Sorry.
They are fair trade coffee. You were right, Mike.
I'm trying to get through this fast. Fair trade coffee. Win for the workers. Win for you. Win for us. Great way to support the show. Freebies, this is bye from us. We'll see you members on the better half of the program. Stay tuned for Sam's interview with Steven Berzuka.
And Sam will definitely 100%
be back tomorrow
for Casual Friday.
All right, folks. See everybody on the fun half. And goodbye, freebies. But see you soon after you become members. Bye-bye.
We are back. Sam Steeter on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Steven Berzuka. He is a senior lecturer in global health and health services at the University of Washington Department of Health Services. Steven, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me, Sam.
And, of course, we're talking at least specifically but also broadly about the chapter you had in the book, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality, edited by David K. Johnston. You have a chapter, Inequality Kills. Before we get to how inequality kills, just give us a sense, put into context where we are as a nation in terms of health.
Well, it depends on how you define health. And since I worked as an emergency doctor for most of my life, 35 years, the easiest diagnosis for me to make in the ER was that somebody was dead. So I like to look at mortality rates. How do we stand up compared to other countries in how long we live, or the report that just came out today, how many women die in childbirth in this country compared to other countries? And we can say, for example, the childbirth report, which dying in dying of maternal causes from delivering a baby. When I was in medical school at Stanford in 1971, in a lecture I actually noted that in 1951-53, we had the lowest maternal mortality ratio of all countries, namely the fewest number of women per capita dying in childbirth. I then wrote that by 1966, other countries had improved more than we had. And the report just released in The Lancet, actually, on the 2nd, that was picked up by the news today, is that our maternal mortality ratio ranks about 41st or 50th among countries. And not only is it high, it's been going up over the last 15 years. In other words, about 18.3 or 4 women per 100,000 births die of childbirth-related causes, whereas in the healthiest countries, it's 2 or 3. So it's a huge difference. Think about it. A woman dying in childbirth, that sounds like something that would happen in Central African Republic or East Timor. My wife works in East Timor, and she's working with the government to try and reduce maternal deaths. But it's remarkably common in this country. Despite all our sophisticated medical services, despite trying to get everybody into prenatal care, all the admonitions to not smoke when you're pregnant, and so on, despite that, a lot of women die in this country from childbirth. That shouldn't be. You know, the richest, most powerful country in world history that spends close to half of the world's health care bill should not have more than 40 countries surpass it in having fewer deaths in childbirth.
Do we have a sense of, do we have a sense of like specifically what accounts for that? I mean, is it more people are having births in their homes? I mean, it's stunning. I float that just because, you know, due diligence, I guess, because it's such a stunning
right.
A fact that we would be moving in the wrong direction.
Right. I mean, not only are we not improving, we're getting worse. And so, you know, the commentary on this says, well, we have a lot of preterm births. Why do we have a lot of preterm births? We have a lot of cesarean sections. They're more dangerous. We do a whole bunch of interventions. But the thing that the studies now are really pointing to is that stress in the woman's life before she becomes pregnant and the stress during the 9 months of pregnancy don't help her survive better. That is, we have very high rates of stress in this country, chronic stress. You know, we're worried about this and that, stuck in traffic, or worried about the significant other coming home and beating you, or worried that the check isn't in the mail. Are we going to feed our family? That kind of stress is really toxic. And I think, you know, the studies would suggest it's a major contributor to our not only high rates of maternal deaths, but deaths throughout the lifespan. And, one could characterize stress as the 21st century tobacco.
All right. Well, let's back up a little bit here, because I think, you know, for the layperson, people don't perceive stress as something that has a, you know, that is something that is tangible that could actually impact your health, let's say like tobacco. But let's go back again to how you're measuring the health of Americans. You measure it through mortality rates. What are other ways that it's measured, and how does that comport with mortality rates? In other words, is there are these two widely divergent measures of health, or are they in some way consistent with each other?
Well, to measure mortality rates, people have to be dead. So, you know, both you and I are speaking on this phone, and so how can we measure our health? That becomes complicated. We could measure our cholesterol, our blood pressure, you know, a whole bunch of sort of markers. Just asking somebody how healthy they are on a scale of 1 to 5 or 1 to 10, and then aggregating those measures for a population actually tends to mirror the mortality rates for that population. So self-assessed health is a measure used in studies where people aren't dead. What they don't do is allow you to compare countries, because a Japanese person, you know, the longest-lived country, isn't going to beat his chest and say, "I'm so healthy." They tend to put themselves down in front of others. It's, you know, it's kind of shameful to stand up in the crowd. Whereas in the United States, we love sort of saying we're the greatest, and so the self-assessed health measures are very good within a culture, but not very good across cultures. So, you know, we actually have higher self-assessed health ratings, say, than Japan, but in Japan they live much, much, much longer than we do. So, but other measures such as you can measure body weights, you know, body mass index, you know, we're the biggest country in the world in terms of our weight. You can measure deaths due to diseases for which medical care can do something. Diseases amenable to medical care, we don't look much better than we do for maternal mortality. That is where we have these studies, even for conditions that medical care treats, we don't do so well.
So in most of the studies that don't involve a self-assessment, it's consistent with more or less with measuring mortality rates.
Yeah, very much. And, you know, the standard mortality measures would be life expectancy. Born today, if today's mortality rates didn't change in the future, how long would you expect to live? How many years? And I call that the Health Olympics. You know, we compete in the Olympic Games. If health were an Olympic event, and the race was mortality rates, you know, how soon you die, we wouldn't be there for the final day's competition. We would have been disqualified in the trials. It's that bad.
And so, and that's not just true of rates of maternity deaths, but also across the board.
Deaths through the lifespan. You know, our infant mortality rate, if you go to our Central Intelligence Agency and you go to the world rankings and you look up infant mortality rate and you see there's about 50 countries that have lower infant deaths than we do. Just to give you an example of the carnage, if we had Sweden's infant mortality rate, we would have 47 fewer babies dying every day in this country. In other words, nobody wants babies to die. But because our infant mortality rate is three times that of Sweden, you just do a simple calculation with, you know, the number of births in this country and how many lives would be saved if we had Sweden's infant mortality rate, and divide that by the number of days, and you end up with 47. Take a country like Cuba. If we had Cuba's infant mortality rate, there'd be 11 fewer deaths a day, every day. That's at the beginning of life. Another sort of measure would be if you're 15 years of age, what are your chances of dying before reaching age 60? You know, that's called adult mortality by the World Health Organization. It's sort of looking at deaths in the prime of life between age 15 and 60. Well, if we take girls in the United States, for example, and we ask, what are your chances of dying for a 15-year-old dying before reaching the age of 60, and compare them with, say, girls in Sri Lanka. Now, I pick Sri Lanka because, you know, it's a poor country. it's a tenth our population, but still, it's 30 million people crowded onto a small island off the southeastern tip of the Indian sub-Indian peninsula, and it underwent a 30-year civil war that only ended in 2009. Believe it or not, a 15-year-old girl has a bigger chance of being alive at age 60 than a 15-year-old American girl. Same would be true for Panama. Same would be true. You know, I could list a whole bunch of other countries. The key point is we die younger than people in all the other rich countries. And then you can find quite a few middle-income and poorer countries in which we die younger than those.
All right. Well, let me just, you know, to bore down into this a little bit more. What if, say, you were to measure women from ages, let's say, 30 to 60? I mean, I ask that because, you know, and again, I'm speaking obviously as a layperson, someone who hasn't dug into these type of statistics, but perhaps the issue is drunk driving. Perhaps it is teen suicide. Perhaps it is a combination of gun violence. Is what happens in this country or a series of events that might be associated with young people in this country in their late teens and early 20s, is that something that is creating the impact? I mean, in other words, is it behaviors that are specific to the United States?
It's a very good question. And I can answer it in a number of ways. Suppose you take how many years of life you have left at age 50. Okay, you've survived birth and you've survived childbearing years, and you're now 50 years of age. How many years do you have left? And compare that with other countries. Well, in that measure, again, we're behind all the other rich countries. That is, our chances of living a long life, if you made it to 50, are less than France or England or Canada or Italy or Greece, even the countries that are, you know, have all the austerity heaped upon them in Europe. I show a graph of how many years you have left from 1955 to 2007 if you're a woman. And in 1955, we had the most years of life of six countries: United States, Japan, France, Australia, and two others that escaped my mind at this point, since I don't have the graphs in front of me. Anyway, in 1955, we had the most years of life to look forward to of all of those six countries, and Japanese women had the least years of life.
This is after the age of 50.
After the age of 50. How many years do you have left at the age of 50? And, you know, from 1955 to about 1980, the curves were more or less, everybody was increasing, and the United States was still in the middle of the pack. And then in 1980, U.S. women began to fall behind. And now, and so by 2007, the Japanese women are way out in front, and the American women are behind all the other five countries. And women have seen the brunt of the poor health status in the United States. That is, I can point to studies that show that death rates for women in over 40% of U.S. counties are actually increasing in the United States. This is a call to action. I mean, babies shouldn't be dying. People shouldn't be dying of childbirth. Women shouldn't be dying at increasing rates. There's something going on in our country, and that's why I titled my chapter Inequality Kills, because it's almost like we have this highly toxic, odorless, colorless, tasteless, invisible gas in our midst that kills us from all the usual things, be they childbirth or child malformations or cancer or heart attacks. It's killing us from all the usual conditions, and it's the gas of inequality. It's ever present in our society, and we're unaware of it.
Is this, I mean, I want to move into there too, but before we even get there, I want to just sort of make sure that we've laid out the premise. So, you know, we're seeing Do we see something similar in men as well? Do we see it in other subgroups in this this country? Go ahead.
Yes, important question. No, it is much more pronounced in women. In other words, I mentioned in over 40% of U.S. counties, women's mortality is going up. It's only 4% of men of counties for men. In other words, men are holding their own. They're not improving at a great rate, but it's women. Something is happening to women in this country in which their health is measurably getting worse.
And so,
and we can speculate on why.
Well, let's do that. I mean, that is a part of what, you know, I guess inequality kills is about, is trying to figure out why that would be happening. And why did it start really dramatically changing at a specific point in time?
Yeah, good question. So, you know, when I bring this up with when I speak, I ask people, so what happened in 1980? And people mention the election of Ronald Reagan. And one can say that our increasing inequality got a real jump start with Reagan. Why women? Well, I think there are enormous expectations on women in our society that are very hard to meet. Think about it. You know, you have a woman who used to just have to be a devoted wife and a caring mother. Now she's got to be successful in the career world. She's got to have the looks of a supermodel. She's got to have the physique of a jock, and she's got to be a porn star. And it's really hard to do all those things. And so the expectations on women are phenomenal, and the amount of government support for women is much, much less. Consider men. You know, we're the same old jerks we've always been. Nothing more is expected of us. We now have women around to sort of do more of the work, and we can sort of go fly fishing. I'm obviously being a little facetious with that, but what do other countries do that's different? Well, they have much more of a sense of support for women in many, many ways. For example, if you're a pregnant woman in all the other rich countries, you get to take up to 18 weeks of paid leave. If you're a working woman outside the home in another country and you're pregnant, you can get up to 18 weeks of paid leave, and that's a federal policy. Once your child is born, there are only 3 countries in the world that don't mandate a federally guaranteed maternity leave policy. One is Papua New Guinea, half of a big island north of Australia. Another is Liberia in West Africa, and the United States is the third. Only 3 countries in the world do not have a federally mandated maternity leave policy. So, you know, I've had students say, well, you know, I had to go back to work in 2 weeks after my baby was born. I had to outsource the care of my baby. That's what we do. And outsourced care is not the same as real parental care. It's why they call it parenting. And, you know, other countries have more wage parity. I mentioned Sri Lanka. You know, if you want to consider the status of women in Sri Lanka, note that the first country to have an elected woman head of state was Sri Lanka in 1958, Bandara Naike. We haven't had an elected head of state yet. Well, so that demonstrates the difference in status of women in the United States, where we pride ourselves on the women's movement and all the advances that have been made. But it's like mortality. Other countries have done better. They're doing things right that we're not.
I mean, it's strange because I don't know. I mean, I think, like, you know, my first thought is perhaps there was more women participating in the workforce maybe through 1950, through, you know, late 70s. I don't know if that's necessarily the case.
No. Women didn't enter the workforce until sometime in the 70s. And why did they enter the workforce in big numbers in the 70s? Well, if you look at wages, hourly wages adjusted for inflation, they have been flat, essentially not increasing since the 1970s. So how did we get to consume all the extra stuff that we have today that we didn't have then? Well, we put women in the workforce. We put children to work. We worked at two or three jobs. And then when that wasn't enough, we borrowed our paycheck out of credit card debt or home equity. Imagine that. In this country, we actually borrow our salary rather than asking the employer to pay for it. It's amazing what we'll do to help the rich get richer.
So the argument is that the reason why we have seen an increase in the mortality rate for women is a function of just essentially how much we are asking them to do, or society is forcing them to do to maintain?
So let me say that, you know, that is my opinion. Now, how do you study that, you see? And what you find studies on, well, women are smoking more in this country, they're eating more, but those are sort of epiphenomenon. What's really happened, I think, has to do with the incredible demands we placed on women and the lack of support. You know, we have the most divorces of all countries. We have the most single parent households. And who are the single parents? They're women for the most part. A study in Sweden showed that single moms have greater death rates than moms in two-parent households. So we haven't done a study like that in this country, but if it's true in Sweden, I'll be darn sure it's true here too. It's this complex of tremendous expectations on women and the lack of support. Plus we have, so many, women are more in poverty than men, and being poor is the bad for your health. It's but the worst thing you can do is to be poor. You know, that's been a response to this by a family doctor, Gary Block, in Toronto. He said if poverty was a disease, then we would have medicine for it. We'd treat it with income. Now, there are a number of studies that sort of look at the effect of income on treating people instead of Prozac or a statin or things like that. Money is good medicine. You know, if you can have, for example, in 1969, a Republican president proposed a guaranteed income for all American families. That was Nixon. His family assistance plan would have given every family a base of income that they wouldn't fall below. We were that close to treating poverty with income, which is what you really need. That legislation, believe it or not, the editorial support in 1969 was 94% in favor. You know, the media, the magazines, TV said it was a great idea. And today, of course, even suggesting it, people laugh at it. Who could imagine that a Republican president proposed this? But that shows how our thinking, our values, our care for others has changed since the late 1960s.
Let's also talk about how I know you've written extensively on how important early childhood health is, or I should say early childhood is to setting essentially the destiny of a person's health. Talk about how that is the case and how that's impacted by wealth inequality.
So roughly half of our health as adults has been programmed. It's the software sort of written in sometime between conception and certainly before we go to school. And I sort of think that the first 1,000 days, by the time you reach age 2, roughly half of our health as adults is determined. And why is that? Well, the child, the fetus, the first 9 months in the womb and the next 2 years after that, the child is programming its physiology through epigenetic means to sort of face the world once it's outside the womb and in the first couple of years for one purpose and one purpose only. That is, we are only put on we're only put here to survive, to reproduce. You know, if you take a Darwinian perspective, which the United States has a lot of people that don't believe in evolution, but be that as it may, from an evolutionary perspective, we're here to reproduce. And we modify our physiology in order to survive, to reproduce. We wouldn't be here as a species. And the modifications we make to our physiology do things, for example, to our blood pressure, our insulin resistance. It affects hormonal cancers such as breast and prostate cancers. So we survive to reproduce, have our babies, and then we pay the price with chronic diseases later. Coronary artery disease, hypertension, hormonal cancers, diabetes. And so the developmental origins of health and disease perspective says that how you're programmed in early life helps you to reproduce, and then you pay the price later with all these illnesses. And because our early life, remember, we don't have any paid antenatal leave, we don't have any paid parental leave in this country, we don't have income supports, we're not treating poverty with money, and so we suffer, and we pay the price later with all these conditions, the chronic diseases of later life.
And so
other countries don't do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, tell us about what the other countries do, because essentially we pay, just our government, even though we have a sort of private health insurance, at least for people who are not over the age of 65, we pay double what the next country, I think it's Canada, pays per capita, yet our outcomes, by any measure, including mortality, is lacking. What do other countries do differently in the context of what you're talking about? Because I know that, you know, we don't necessarily have the highest smoking rate. We don't have the highest alcohol consumption rate.
Right.
I mean, we don't.
Right.
Theoretically, our health should be better.
It should be better. Well, take France, for example. They drink more than we do. Take Japan. They smoke twice as much as we do. The men, the women don't in Japan don't smoke much. But what do these countries do? I mentioned Sweden before and its infant mortality rate. So in Sweden, it's mandatory to take a year's maternity leave at full pay. Mm. It's actually joint maternity, paternity. You split it among the father and the mother. And if the mother takes the whole 12 months, the father's got to take 3 months because they see the importance of the father in this. And this is at full pay. Now, Sweden has very high tax rates. So it's actually the Swedish government that pays you your salary, not the business or company that you work for. In Sweden, the second year is optional at only 80 of maternity leave is optional at only 80% pay. And you know, most parents do that. In the third year in Sweden, you can put your child in a Swedish government-run daycare center that's essentially free. And the requirements to work in a Swedish government daycare center are that you have an advanced degree in play. Because what's daycare all about? It's socializing the kid, and you need experts. So Sweden recognizes that. And if you take Sweden has a big government that, you know, it consumes a large amount of the GNP. And you ask, where does the Swedish government spend its money on the years of life? You know, our government spends all its money on people 65 and older. The Swedish government spends more money on the first year of life than in any subsequent year, because it understands that is the special period where we need to have good policies, and because then we won't have to pay a lot of money for medical care later in life, since we've done our homework in the beginning. And the same is true for other countries. I mean, I don't live far from Canada. And a friend of mine, who was a high school teacher in Kingston, Ontario, he was married to a doctor, and they had twins. And she went back to work, and because they had twins, he was able to put together 2 years of paternity leave. He stayed home with the kids. He was really very good at that. And, you know, it wasn't at full pay, but 2 years at a pretty high pay to take care of the twins. And that's what Canada does. You know, it has a very generous paternity leave policy. Well, maternity, paternity, you know, in this family leave. In this case, you know, he took the leave since his wife went back to work.
And so
it varies from country to country, but it's all variations on that theme.
Now, is there, I mean, what is the strongest causal connection as opposed to just simply a correlation between those policies on the way that a state will support early parenthood, I guess? What's the strongest case for correlation?
Early life matters, I should say. You know, the most. I mean, it depends on how you're going to look at evidence. You take, for example, to try and bring it home, and to bolster the stress argument. Women in New York City who were near ground zero on September 11th who were pregnant, their kids are now, you know, 10 years old or so, 12, 13 years old, sorry. When we study the outcomes, not the women that were exposed to stuff falling out of the sky, just women who were near there and exposed to the stress of that event. Their children now have a lot of cognitive neural delays. In other words, you can measure compromises in their health because their mothers were extremely stressed when they were in utero. And so, you know, societies privilege pregnancy. Other societies here, we make women work at two or three jobs when they're pregnant. And so we have these natural experiments. Katrina's another one that I could describe. You know, women who are pregnant in New Orleans when the hurricane hit have had compromises in their children. And then you have examples such as the Dutch hunger winter in World War II. There were severe rationing of food in Holland. And so they've been following the women who were pregnant at that time and noting which women were in their first trimester, their second, their third trimester. And now these people are in their 60s and 70s. And so we see the diabetes. We see the schizophrenia. We see the heart attacks. We see those depending on when the stress occurred in which trimester of pregnancy. So, you know, you have animal models, experiments, you have natural experiments such as the ones I've mentioned, and we have biology worked out on how these things help, how all these factors play in. It's just something that we don't even consider in this country because the Declaration of Independence says we're all born equal. Nothing could be further from the truth. But we sort of believe in that in that myth, and then we think life is what we make of it. But life is what, you know, what your parents or your grandparents, with the circumstances they had, that produced the conditions that made you be who you are today. And we don't recognize that in this country, whereas other societies do.
All right. Well, lastly, I mean, if there were two policies that you were in a position to implement, I mean, what would be, in terms of health outcomes, in terms of extending mortality rates, what would they be?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is level our inequality. We have to level the playing field, and that could be restoring the minimum wage. You know, what it was in 1966 was much higher in inflation-adjusted terms than it is today. Having a maximum wage, such as we gave Japan, and when we occupied Japan after the Second World War, we legislated a maximum wage because we thought the inequality was bad. So we had to have a maximum wage and a minimum wage that don't differ by more than a factor of 10, which is how they were in this country in the 1950s.
Because let me just stop you there, because presumably the less inequality, the more resources are spent on people at the lower end of the income spectrum, and it also does what? It reduces the stress. I've read research in the past that has shown actually during recessions, health outcomes go up.
That's right.
Explain that dynamic.
Yes, mortality is pro-cyclical. Pro-cyclical meaning it follows the business cycle. When business cycle booms, mortality goes up, and when the business cycle is in recession, relatively speaking, mortality doesn't go up.
That's pretty counterintuitive. Why does that happen?
Right. So think about it. When when the economy was booming in the late 1990s, and you know the dot-com bubble, and so on, people were trying to get a piece of the pie, and so they were working two or three jobs. They had no time for their families. They were stressed out by this, so they drank and smoked more. And you can see these behaviors play out, and they were getting into car crashes. I remember in 2008 in the fall when things were really looking pretty serious, and I looked at our trauma hospital here in Seattle, and the census was way down. You know, we didn't have a lot of car crashes in the ICUs then, and to me it just was verifying what is true, namely there wasn't the road rage out there that caused all these crashes, because people weren't working two or three jobs. They were getting laid off. They could stay home with the kids. Hmm. That actually happened. They stayed home with their kids. It's a bizarre thing to suggest. I mean, you know, but there's a lot of research on mortality being pro-business cycle going back to the 1800s. And when the first studies were published in about 1926, you know, these biostatisticians published these data, and they said, this is really crazy, but this is what the data show. And the studies since then have essentially affirmed those results. I wrote a review paper on this back in, after the Great Recession started, because I was just amazed at discovering this and wanting to let others know. So there are people who believe that. I mean, what we should be striving for in this country is to not try to grow the economy so everybody's working too hard. In the 1970s, I remember we thought leisure time was going to increase so much and we'd all have this time to sort of spend with our family and friends, and that hasn't happened because our wages have been flat and we've had to work too hard, and it's killing us.
Right. I mean, productivity has gone up per worker enormously over the past 30 years, and,
right.
and wages
right.
have not kept pace. Which means we're basically just working harder under more pressure. And so the idea is, I guess, during recessions is that you are forced off the spinning wheel, I guess.
Yeah, we're forced off the treadmill.
Off the treadmill. And
we have more time.
And what would be that second thing? You talk about...
take the gains from decreasing inequality and spend it on early life. How would you spend it on early life? Well, paid leave policies. You know, look at what year of the lifespan we spend our money on. Let's not be one of three countries that doesn't have a paid maternity leave policy. Let's have a paid antenatal leave policy. Let's have, if people are going to work and not outside the home, then let's have really good daycare. Follow the Swedish model and get experts in there. Let's spend money on so people have a guaranteed income. They don't have to worry about busting everything to try and put food on the table. And people would be less worried, less scared, more trusting, because when inequality decreases, when everybody's on a more level playing field, pretty well everything gets better. You know, inequality has been linked to so many bad things, and there are very few arguments against it when you look at what are the benefits to society. It's sort of a win-win situation. We even have studies suggesting that the rich in this country would be healthier, that is, live longer, if they were less rich in a smaller gap society. Hmm. The only thing is, it's hard to convince the rich that they should be less rich and they'd be better off, but that's what the data show.
Stephen Bezruchka from the University of Washington School of Public Health. The book is The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. Thanks so much for your time today. Fascinating stuff.
Been my pleasure. Thank you, Sam.